Okay, we're going to begin Parshas Maaseh, which is on page 918. Needless to say, obviously, when we learn today, we should, of course, have in mind Am Yisrael, Chal Yisrael, people in Eretz Yisrael, the Chayalim of the IDF, and their safety, and so on and so forth. Only good news. Parshas Maaseh is always page 918. Parshas Maaseh is always in the 3 weeks, and the Shabbos that we read Maaseh is always Shabbos Mevorchim. It's always the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Av, which is incredible because, I mean, we often mention this, but it's so amazing how you see this sometimes where the Parshas were just instituted to read them in order, but the Shalah HaKodesh, the great Kabbalist, the Shalah always says that there's always a connection between the Parsha and the events of the week or things that happen during that week. And the connection between Parshas Maaseh and the 3 weeks and the 9 days particularly, or Chodesh Av, is very, very strong. A couple of things. First of all, well, just from the beginning of the Parsha talks about the journeys, the travels of Bnei Yisrael from when they come, they left Mitzrayim until the Jordan, the place called Yarden Yerechoi, which is just outside Eretz Yisrael. 42 stops, but of course the Mepharshim explained those 42 stops represent not only the travel from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael, but the travel from Mitzrayim all the way to Mashiach. So that's obviously connected with the rebuilding of the temple and the whole idea of the 3 weeks. An incredible connection is that at the beginning of the Parsha, where it talks about all the stops, all the travels, one of the places it talks about is the place where Aaron, Moshe Rabbeinu's brother, passed away. He passed away in a place called Horahar. Now, his death is already mentioned a few parashas ago in Parashas Chukas. But interestingly enough, where it's mentioned in its right place, so to speak, it doesn't actually mention the date that he passed away. Where when it mentions in this week's parasha, it mentions the date that he passed away, which is Rosh Chodesh Av, the first of Av, which is always in the week of Parashas Maaseh. It's always the week after we read the Parashas Maaseh, which is phenomenal. It just happens, you know, comes out like that. So, now of course, his death itself, the whole concept of Aaron HaKohen, is very much connected with the 3 weeks, because we know that Aaron HaKohen stood for the concept of loving peace and pursuing peace, as it says in Pirkei Avos. And we know that the second temple specifically was destroyed because of baseless hatred, and therefore the 3 weeks, we are told, always is a time to strengthen love, to strengthen unity, which was of course the whole idea of Aaron. Aaron put his whole life mission to bring people together, to resolve disputes, to bring husband and wife together, friends that are fighting together, and so on and so forth. The other very strong connection, of course, is that in this week's Parsha, specifically in this week's Parsha, obviously also very much connected with the current situation in Eretz Yisrael, this week's Parsha talks about them going into the land of Israel, inheriting the land of Israel, dividing up the land of Israel, and particularly a big description of the borders of Eretz Yisrael. And what constitute the borders of the land of Israel, and what belongs to the Jewish people, and so on and so forth. So that's obviously a very, very strong connection. But I'm going to take it a little bit further and look at something else in the Parsha, and we'll bring it back to the whole idea of the 3 weeks as well, and the Beis Hamikdash. Obviously the 3 weeks is also a time that we try and reflect on what happened. So what happened in the 3 weeks is the 3 weeks culminates in the 9th of Av. 9th of Av is the day that both temples, both Beit Hamikdash, were destroyed. And that's why the 3 weeks is also a time to focus on the whole idea of what the Beis Hamikdash is, the building of the Beis Hamikdash, and of course the prayer that the Beis Hamikdash becomes rebuilt. Right? So we're going to have a look at a particular issue which comes out of a particular part of the Parsha, which I'm just going to find. It's the part, here we are. It's the part that talks about the Orei Miklat, the cities of refuge, on page 926. We'll start. Now, this concept comes out a number of times in the Torah, but the way it's introduced in this week's Parsha is through the... there's extra chumash in there. Page 926. So we're going to learn this concept, but the way it's introduced is, first of all, the Torah talks about, as I said, going into the land of Israel. inheriting the land of Israel and the borders. But one of the things that Torah talks about again in this week's parasha is the fact that the tribe of Levi weren't given a portion of the land of Israel. We know that, right? So Israel was given to the 12 tribes, meaning the 12 tribes other than the tribe of Levi. Tribe of Levi, and they were all given land to farm and became pretty much an agricultural society. But the tribe of Levi weren't given a part of the land of Israel. They were, their function was not to farm the land. Their function was really to move around and either serve in the temple or teach people Torah. That was their function. They were the more spiritual tribe. So where do they live? So the way the system works is there's like a housing commission system that the Torah develops, that when the people go into Israel, there were cities, small cities that were established all over Israel to be places where the tribe of Levi lives. Okay. And the way it's broken up, we're not going to go into that aspect, we once did this before, but just to give you a bit of background to what we're going to learn, the way it's broken up is that there were 42 cities given to the tribe of Levi, plus an extra 6 cities, 3 on the one side of the Jordan River, 3 on the other side, that were reserved for cities of refuge, for people that kill unintentionally, which we're going to go into in a minute. But the truth is that all the 48 cities served the same purpose, because the cities of refuge also became cities for the tribe of Levi, and we'll see why, it had to be both things. And the 42 cities, which were the cities of the tribe of Levi, also served as cities of refuge. So they both served both functions. But nevertheless, the 42 cities were known as the cities of the Levi, the Levim, and the 6 cities were known as the cities of refuge. So let's just learn some of the psukim, how the Torah introduces this, and then we'll go into it, and go into a particular aspect of it. So the Torah says, it's page 926, chapter 35, Lamed Hei, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Right, in the middle of the page. So, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe. Hashem spoke to Moshe, Ve'arvois Moav, in the plains of Moab, meaning before the Jewish people went into Israel. Al Yarden Yerecha, Lamer, on the border of the place called Yarden Yerecha. Saying, Tzavos b'nei Yisrael, command the Jewish people, V'nosnu l'alavim, and they should give to the Levites, they should give the tribe of Levi, Minachlas achuzosam, from their inheritance. In other words, give up some cities. Orim l'shaves, cities for the tribe of Levi to settle. They needed a place to stay. Or migrash l'orim, so the same in a place around the sort of a an open place around the cities, so the same titnu l'alvin, had to have a place for the animals and so on. V'hoyu ha'orim l'hem l'shaves, the cities will be for them to live in. Or migrashayim, in the open spaces, yiyu l'vehemtem, will be for the animals if they have some. V'lerchusham, for the assets, whatever they have. L'chol chayosam, for everything that's attached to their livelihood. Now, turn over the page. We'll skip to Pasuk Tes, verse 9. And here we have another section in continuation with this. Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe Lamer, and Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, Daber al Bnei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people. Ve'amartem aleihem, and say to them, Ki atem oivrim es hayarden artso kanoan, you are going into the Yarden, to Eretz Canaan. The land of Israel was called Eretz Canaan. V'hikrisem lachem orim, designate for yourselves cities, orei miklot tihiyana lachem, they will be cities of refuge. V'nos shama, and who will go there? V'nos shama roitzeach, the murderer will flee there. Who's this murderer that we're talking about? Makei nefesh bishgogo, the person who kills an innocent person unintentionally. V'hoyu lachem ha'orim l'miklot migoel, those cities will be a refuge for the murderer from the goel. The goel is the redeemer of the blood, the next of kin, the relative who might want to take revenge. V'lo yomus ha'retzeach ad omdo lifnei eidel ha'mishpat, and in the first instance, if someone kills, they should immediately be transferred to the cities of refuge under protection. And then they will stand trial, and then the trial will determine what their status is. If the trial determines that their status is a status of an unintentional murderer, and I'm going to define that for you in a minute, then he has to go back to the cities of refuge and remain there, sort of a punishment, which I'll explain. Now, let's go a little bit further. Says the pasuk, "V'ha'orim asher titenu," the cities that you give, that you designate, "Sheish orim mikot," there should be 6 cities of refuge, tiyana lachem. 3 on the one side of the Yarden, 3 on the other side of the Yarden. Now, just turn over the page. We're going to go to Pasuk Chafei. Pasuk 25. But before we do Pasuk 25, I'm going to give you a bit of a background. First of all, just to understand what's going on here in terms of this whole halacha of the unintentional murderer, we need to understand the following. First of all, the justice system in the Torah justice system that was given to the Jewish people to administer when they went into the land of Israel, under their court system and under their Sanhedrin and so on and so forth, is a very specific and very unique sort of justice system. Right? And we're supposed to work in a very specific way. The punishments that we find in the Torah, first of all, have a dual purpose. Number one, punishments are there as a deterrent, as they would be in any society, I suppose. But in the Torah, actually, the purpose of punishments is much deeper than that, and much primarily for a different reason. Punishments that were given in the Torah were actually there as an atonement. When a person commits a crime, they create a blemish, they cause a negative blemish to take place on their own personality, on their own soul. And therefore the punishments that the Torah gives are there as an atonement. And in fact, if a person receives a punishment administered by the Beis Din, by the court, whether it's capital punishment or lashes as sometimes in the Torah, or exile, as we'll soon see, this form of a series of refuge, it becomes actually a benefit for the person, because what we are taught is that when a person is able to get the punishment in this world, they receive their atonement, so that if eventually their soul leaves this world, they actually leave this world in a much more clean and pure state. If a person commits a transgression and never gets punished in this world, they're actually worse off, because when their neshama leaves this world, they suffer in a much, much greater way, and they come to the world to come in an impure state. Okay, that's just a couple of introductions. That's the first idea. The second idea is that the justice system that was given was a justice system that was very logical. In other words, with logical laws and a court system, a system of a whole court process, as would be in any society. But the difference would be is that the Jewish court system, the Jewish justice system, worked simultaneously with a divine spiritual justice system. Right? And therefore the belief was very strong that if someone comes to court after having committed a crime, and for whatever reason the court's not able to convict him or her, and therefore not able to punish him, and there's no justice, there's no such thing as no justice. Because if the court, the physical court, the court of human flesh and blood, is not able to bring a person to justice, God will take care of the rest. So it's a partnership, so to speak, between God and the Jewish people, God and the court. Whatever the court's not able to do, because they were bound by the laws that God gives us, God takes care of the rest. So it's not like, the reason I'm giving this introduction is because sometimes we see that things that are more severe or appear to be more severe, the person gets off more than if it's less severe. And I'll give you an example from this part of the Chumash in a second. Okay, but that doesn't matter, because we only do half the process. The other process, God fills in the gaps. Why am I bringing this introduction? So let's talk about that concept of murder. So this topic is a very, very complicated topic. Takes up an entire chapter in the Talmud, so we're certainly not going to be able to go through it now. But I'll just summarize it for you in very, very brief. Essentially, there's four scenarios, just so you get the meaning of what's going on in this parasha. I don't think we've ever done this before, so let's do it properly now. There's four scenarios of murder, or manslaughter, as they call it sometimes today. One is if someone just intentionally murders another person, kills another person, right? Now, we know in the Torah, that's a capital crime, and the Torah believes in capital punishment under very strict circumstances. And that's a crime where if a person is brought to Beis Din, they can be put to death. They can be executed as a punishment for killing someone else. Right? That's not always so simple, because there has to be witnesses, there has to be warning, the witnesses have to be interrogated. There's a lot of steps to go through until a court of law can actually, in a thorough way, convict someone and actually put them to death. But that is the official punishment. If the Beis Din is not able to do that, again, we believe is God will take care of it a different way. But that is the system of the way it works. The second scenario is... No, actually, let me go to the third scenario. The third scenario is where a person kills unintentionally, but it's not completely unavoidable. So I'll give you the classic case that Torah gives. Right? A person goes and chopping down a tree, doing an innocent thing, he's chopping down a tree, and didn't realize that the axe that he was using is a little bit loose. So as he's chopping down the tree, the iron part of the axe detaches, flies off the handle, literally, and hits someone and kills them. Right? So that's a mistake. It's an innocent mistake. But it's not a complete mistake. The Torah actually puts some responsibility on the person. Because as responsible human beings, we have an obligation to live in a very responsible way. To the point where you're going out and you're chopping a tree, it's a potentially dangerous act to do. You've got to check your axe to make sure it's strong. Now, it was an innocent mistake. But nevertheless, if it happens to this person is not completely pure, the person is not completely innocent. And therefore, the Torah actually says that the person deserves a level of punishment. The punishment is there as an atonement. Right? And this punishment is the punishment to run away to the cities of refuge. It's almost like a prison sentence. Now, so when I say it's almost like a prison sentence, it's actually very interesting. Because this is the only time we find anything in the Torah remotely connected or similar to prison. Generally, in the Torah does not believe in prison. It's an interesting thing. The Torah doesn't believe in jail punishment. And there are very, very exceptional circumstances. And in order to protect society, you've got to capture someone. That's a separate thing, just to keep people safe. So obviously, if someone is walking around with a gun, based on the court, would have to catch them and put them into custody so they're protected. But not as a punishment. Right? And part of the reason is because it doesn't work. It actually doesn't work. It's an interesting thing. I've read up a little bit about it. If you look at the statistics of how effective jail terms are, as a deterrent and as a rehabilitative thing, it's actually a disaster. You know, in the States, there are close to 3 million people in prison. They're like addicted to jailing. Right? Because it doesn't work. And the level of reoffense is incredibly high. Incredibly high. Even Australia also. The only time the Torah has something remotely similar to prison is this unintentional murderer who has to go there and he's exiled from his family and has to stay there for a period amount of time. But it's very different to prison because it's a very, very rehabilitative... It is prison, meaning it's exile, it's limiting, they take away his freedom, he's not allowed to go out of the city. So when a person's freedom is restricted, that's a painful thing. But because the Torah deems this person as a person who is spiritually insensitive, who's not a perfect person, who needs rehabilitation because he had the insensitivity not to take full cautionary measures to make sure that he's completely safe. So his atonement or her atonement would be actually being away from his or her family. But where do they go? They go to a city and live together with the most spiritual people of Am Yisrael, the tribe of Levi. Almost like a bonus, but restricting. Right? It was a whole system. It was a whole system. I mean, it was tax-based funds, I guess. But it was a whole system that had to live there properly, and they could have jobs there. They were eating there. There was water. There were certain rules of how that town was run. Otherwise, there couldn't be weapons brought into the town. I mean, there was like certain rights taken away from them. But otherwise, it was a full normal life, and the country a much more spiritual life because they were with and under the influence and under the guidance of the Levim.
Without their family,
No, I think not. I think that was part of the. Oh, and I think they could. I think you could see them. Yeah, I don't remember. Let's talk about the word.
I'm wondering how the inhabitants. I don't know if they were all learned people, but how would the inhabitants feel about their city being invaded by?
Wasn't very. That was part of the responsibility, part of the role of the Levim that of the tribe of Levi that lived there was to have an influence on these people. I mean, assuming it wasn't overcrowded, one would hope. But right, so that's the third scenario of murder. Now we'll talk about how long they had to stay there in a minute. And that's actually the topic we're going to talk about. Now the reason I skipped to number three is because there's a stage in the middle. So there's intentional murder, and then there's unintentional murder, but some responsibility. And then there's something which we call karov lemezi, which means someone who killed who was negligent, who was purely negligent. So it wasn't intentional, but they went around doing dangerous things and they killed. That's a very difficult category. Because that person, it's not bad enough to warrant capital punishment, but they're not sent to the city of refuge either. And the reason is, the Gemara explains, is because the city of refuge won't help them. In other words, it won't be enough of an atonement. A punishment is only given to someone in the Torah if it serves as an atonement. If it won't be enough to atone for them, they're not given it. So the obvious question is, but then they get off freer, they get off more lenient than the person who's better, and the answer is no, because we believe in the simultaneous partnership between God's justice and human justice, and therefore God will have to take care of it, which is an interesting idea. So, level one is intentional murder, level two is negligence. I suppose the modern translation that would be like drunk driving and you kill someone. That's not murder, but it's still negligent murder. So that person wouldn't go to the city of refuge, but wouldn't be capital punishment either. the unintentional murder, the accident with the tree, and then the fourth category is completely unavoidable. Right? Person standing on the top of a roof, doing nothing, minding his own business. Someone comes to push him, whatever, it falls down. Something completely unforeseeable happens, and unfortunately, he kills someone. So that's completely unavoidable, and person has no responsibility for that, and therefore that doesn't have any punishment whatsoever. How long does the person have to stay in the city of refuge? Let's have a look at the pasuk. The pasuk Chafei, that's verse 25. So the pasuk says, "V'hitzilu ha'edo aseretzeach." The congregation, the court, shall sort of protect the murderer, miyad goel adam, from the avenger. "V'yishivo ise ha'edo u'miklati ashenasham," and they should put him in the cities of refuge, protect him initially. But then even once everything dies down, if he was deemed to be an unintentional murderer, he has to go back to the city of refuge and be there in isolation, so to speak. V'yoshav bo, he has to sit there and dwell there. Ad mois ha-koyen ha-godel, asher moshach oisei b'shemen ha-koydesh. Until the death, until the passing of the high priest. The high priest who was anointed. That's the halacha. The guy who lands up in the Orei Miklat stays there until the high priest dies. By the way, just on a side, I think we've mentioned this before, but a fascinating thing comes out of this. The Gemara says that the mother of the Kohen Gadol would visit, the mother of the high priest would visit the cities of refuge and really take care of the murderers. Give them food and shower them with stuff. Why? Because she was petrified that they would daven that the high priest should die. Right? Because they want to get out of there. Which the commentaries point out demonstrates an incredible concept of the power of davening. Who are we talking about? We're talking about someone that's landed up in jail essentially because they need an atonement, not a very, very spiritual person. A person who is negligent enough to be responsible enough to cause murder. And yet we worry that this person really strongly davens to God about the holiest person, the person who was designated as the representative of the Jewish people, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, that he should die, it might have some negative effect. Which is, shows the power of davening, right? Anyway, so the mother of the Kohen Gadol would go to the city's refuge and sort of really take care of these people, so they shouldn't be so tempted to daven for the Kohen Gadol's death. Okay, so they would be there until the death of the Kohen Gadol. So let's just summarize before we run. So a person runs to the city of refuge, and the city of refuge essentially achieves two purposes. One is the protection. It's like protective custody, so to speak. The person's in our mikla. What protection from what? From what we call the goel hadam, from the next of kin. Now that's a whole other topic you have to leave for a different time. Very complicated topic because there is a concept that if someone is murdered and the closest relative kills the murderer, the closest relative is absolved. So in other words, they sometimes have some sort of immunity. And that needs to be understood as a very complicated part. We're not going to go into that today. But the most important thing is that the guy runs and he has to stay in the cities of refuge as an atonement, as a cleansing process, as a purification process, until the death of the Kohen Gadol. Now, why the death of the Kohen Gadol? What's the death of the high priest got to do with the unintentional murder? So let me just go through for you a couple of reasons. First of all, Rashi brings two reasons. Rashi says that the Kohen Gadol symbolized or stood for, he was the person who davened, who led the Jewish people, who's responsible for the divine presence to rest among the people. He was the person who served in the temple. He was the person that would cause or bring the Shekhinah, the divine presence, to rest and to be revealed among the Jewish people. Which of course, therefore, was a symbol of longevity. God is a symbol of life. God is a symbol of longevity. Therefore, the Kohen Gadol became synonymous with the concept of long life and life. This person was a person who shortened someone's life in a way where they bear some responsibility. Because this is a person, so therefore, kind of, they don't coexist, they clash. The concept of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and this murderer sort of clash, and therefore the atonement is that he stays in the Arab Miklat, he stays in the cities of refuge until the Kohen Gadol dies, until the Kohen Gadol passes away. Okay. That's one reason. Another reason, interesting reason that Rashi brings, a completely opposite reason, is that the reason that it's connected with the passing of the high priest is because the high priest bears some responsibility. It's a fascinating concept. Tzaddikim, leaders of generation, bear some responsibility to daven to Hashem, to guide the people, to ensure that things run properly. When things don't run properly, there's many sources in the Torah that God places. Obviously, a person is always responsible themselves, in this case too, which is why the person lands up in a citizen refuge. But nevertheless, some responsibility always goes onto the leadership, and therefore they bear some responsibility, and therefore the sitting of the guy in the citizen refuge becomes connected to the death of the Kohen Gadol. And the third reason that I've seen is that the atonement of the murderer becomes complete when the high priest dies, because we have a concept that's brought in Midrashim and in Gemara, that when a tzaddik passes away, that in itself causes an atonement. It's like an atonement for the Jewish people, and therefore when a person sits in the citizen of refuge, plus the demise, plus the passing of the tzaddik, that becomes like an atonement. Okay. But I'm going to take this, so that's one reason. But let's take this now to a whole other level and understand the connection between what this person is doing in the citizen of refuge to the Kohen Gadol. And I'm going to share with you an insight taken from one of the talks of the Rebbe, of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. A very, very interesting idea. Based on a concept which I've shared with you many times, that often when we see a concept in Mishnah or Halacha or Gemara, that concept operates on many, many, many levels, right? So it operates on the halachic literal level, but then there's always a deeper layer to understand what is going on. Now I'm going to share with you something to do with the Beis HaMikdash, because generally in the 3 weeks it's a good idea to learn about the Beis HaMikdash. But as this happens to be to do with the Kohen Gadol, to do with the high priest, and then we'll bring it back to the whole idea of the guy sitting in the citizen of refuge. So the concept is like this. If you have a look at the hand that I've given you, just understand what the Kohen Gadol, what the high priest stood for. So it looks like a very complicated drawing. What I've given you is essentially a bird's eye view. It's a plan of the second temple. Okay? So I don't know how I can... Let me just... Yeah. So if you look at this, if you look at over here, it's not laid out completely. The top is the west, okay? Just think about it like this. It should really be held
other way.
Like this. But let's hold like this. Okay, so this is west, this is east. This is north, this is south, okay? This part, if you have a look at this part, you see where I'm going in the middle. This part is the building of the temple. It's where it had a roof, right? And it's actually divided, if you look in the middle here, it's divided into two parts. This little room over here is called the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. That was the holiest room in the temple, and that had the Aron, and had the Ark. This room, and this antechamber over here, that was called the Kodesh, the holy part of the temple, and that had three very holy vessels, the candelabra, the showbread table, and a very small altar for bringing incense. This part over here was the outside, the courtyard of the temple. Okay? And that had the big altar upon which they bring sacrifices. And this was a very big courtyard where the people would gather. When, like Yom Tov, or people would come in and they would gather here, and people said this is where they would gather. Now, by the way, the western wall, the kotel, is somewhere, it's like this wall. Right? It's the wall closest to the Holy of Holies. It's not actually the wall of the courtyard. There was another wall. It was the wall of Temple Mount, because this whole structure was surrounded by a wall that was known the wall that was known as the wall of the courtyard. And then there was another wall which is known as the wall of Temple Mount, and that's the wall. The Kosam Arav is the wall of the Temple Mount. Okay. Now that's this layout, the basic layout of the temple. But here, look at this plan. You see all these little things all around. What is this? These are all different, and all these little like chambers, a little room, little hole, little squares. In the layout of the temple, there were many, many chambers. There were many, many rooms, offices, right? And they were called lishkas. That was the word. A lishka means like a room, a chamber. There was one particular chamber, there was one particular room that was called, well, that had two names. Let me tell you what it was first, and we'll understand its names. It was the room of the Kohen Gadol, essentially. It was the room of the high priest. What was that room for? That was a room, the Mishnah about Yom Kippur tells us, that we know there was one day of the year where the high priest, he was the one that had to lead the service, which was Yom Kippur, right? And Yom Kippur was the high priest, had to bring all the sacrifice and bring the incense, and he was the one that went into the Holy of Holies. He was one that represented, it was a very busy and very complicated day for the high priest. The rest of the year, the other Kohanim did the stuff. If he wanted to, he could, but he didn't have to. On Yom Kippur, he was the one that had to do everything. So what would they do? 7 days before Yom Kippur, they would quarantine the Kohen Gadol, so to speak, and put him in this room. He would stay in a special room in the temple, where they would make sure he didn't come into contact with any impurity. They would train him. They would make sure he knows what to do with all the animals, what to do with the they would. It was a training session. Make sure he was up to date, fit and ready to serve and represent the Jewish people on Yom Kippur. Now, what was this room called? So we find in Gemara two names for this room in different places. One place it's called Lishkat Ha'etz, the room of wood. Why was it named the room of wood? So according to many commentaries, because part of its structure was made with wood, which was very unusual, because most of the whole structure of the temple was stone, and in the Kohen Gadol's room somehow there was wood built into it. And this causes a whole problem. Why does it cause a whole problem? I'll just give you the background to what we're going to do. Because in the Rambam, there's a famous Rambam, where the Rambam talks about the laws of building the Beis HaMikdash. And the Rambam says that one of the things you have to know about building the temple is, different to the Mishkan, different to the tabernacle that was built in the desert, the Rambam says that one is not permitted to build wood into the structure at all. It cannot be part of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. It's got to be built out of stone, right? The reason for it is because there's a pasuk, there's a verse in the Torah that says that one may not plant any trees in the Temple Mount, and one, like the whole Temple Mount had no trees, there were no trees there. Why? Because that was the practice of pagan worshippers. In pagan worshippers, particularly in that time, in their temples, in their fields where they would serve idols, part of it they would sometimes serve trees, or they would plant trees for shade, and it was part of the whole structure of pagan worship practice. And therefore, the Torah warns us that in our temple there should be no trees, and by extension, no wood for that matter. Right? That's what the Rambam says. On the Rambam, there was a colleague of the Rambam called the Ravid, and he often argued with the Rambam. And the way it's printed today, it's printed in some Rambams, have little notes at the side wherever the Ravid comes in and he argues. And the Ravid asks a very, very important question. He says, "What do you mean? How can you say you're not allowed to put wood into the structure of the temple? There was the room of the Kohen Gadol, which was called Lishka Soetz. It was called the room of wood, presumably because it was made out of wood. So what's this Rambam talking about?" Okay. And there are many, many answers given to this question. The classic answer that is given by most commentaries is a very interesting answer. And that is that it's true that the room of the Kohen Gadol had wood, but it wasn't visible. The Rambam, if you look at the wording of the Rambam says very clearly that one may not build wood in the temple, but he uses the term etz bolet, which means protruding wood, visible wood. Right? If you build wood somehow into the structure, but it's covered over, then it's okay. So the commentaries bring various sources to tell us that what happened with this room, different to the rest of the temple, was as follows. When they built this room for the high priest, they built it with wood, yeah, but then they plastered it over. So it had a wooden structure. It's like building a wall with chip rock, but then painting it over, or plastering it over with something else, right? So it was covered in cement, so it looked like it was stone, but in fact, inside it was wood, right? And that's why it was okay. That's the answer, how they resolved the Rambam's issue. So the obvious question is...
Why?
Sorry?
Why?
Yeah, exactly. So why? So you go build a room, you call it Lishkata 8, you call it the room of wood, presumably because wood plays a very, very important role there. Right? And then you cover it over. Now, they covered it over because there was a halacha, you're not allowed to have any visible wood in the temple. Okay, but then why have it all together? In other words, so then why was it so important to have wood there? So, the Kabbalists explain that the reason there was wood was because wood is a symbol, there's a pasuk, there's a verse in Yeshayahu, wood is a symbol of longevity. There's a verse in the prophet of Isaiah that says that the eternity of the Jewish people is compared to a strong tree, right? We know trees are from those things that we experience that probably last the longest, to outlive many, many other things, right? Generations sometimes. So wood, therefore, which obviously is the concept of a tree, wood represents the idea of longevity. The Kabbalists further explain that we know that the difference in a Kohen and a Levi, right, is that it's a famous concept that the Kohen is very much connected with Chesed. We have Chesed and Gevura. Kohen, the Kohanim are Aaron was Chesed, very much connected with the concept of Chesed, whereas Levi is connected with Gevura. Right? Now Chesed is the concept of giving, of love, of revelation, of unlimitedness, infinity. No borders, no stopping, no boundaries. Right? Boundaries is a gevura concept. Chesed is synonymous with the idea of infinity. Therefore, the concept of longevity, the idea of long life, is specifically connected with the concept of chesed. And therefore, since Kohanim, and particularly the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is a symbol of chesed, therefore the Kohen Gadol becomes a symbol of longevity, which is also connected with the idea of wood, and that's why his room had to have wood in it. Right? His room had to have wood in it. Fine. That's fine. Okay, so now we've resolved the whole thing halachically, which means that you couldn't have visible wood because you're not allowed to have visible wood in the temple. But you had to have wood because wood has a very special connection to the Kohen Gadol, to the high priest. So therefore there is wood in his chamber. It's even called Nishkata, it's even called the room of wood, but it was covered over because you can't have visible wood in it. So the Rebbe asks a very fascinating question. He says, that's all good, but you know, in Torah everything has to work. So it's not good enough just to say that his room had to be connected to wood, but there's some side issue that prevented us from having the wood visible, because there's a general concept you can't have visible wood in the temple, so therefore it's covered over. So it's almost like the Kohen Gadol's room had to be very much strongly connected with wood, but it becomes a little bit diluted because there's another side law that prevents us from having visible wood. The Rebbe's thesis is that's not possible. If at the end of the day, halakha determines that his room was connected with wood, but yet the wood was covered, the fact that the wood was covered has to do also with something to do with the Kohen Gadol. It also must be somehow tied into the concept of the high priest. And that we have to understand what that means. On the one hand, the high priest is connected with wood. Are we okay? Are we following? On the one hand, the Kohen Gadol is connected with wood. On the other hand, the very same concept of the Kohen Gadol was connected with covered up wood, hidden wood. Why? What's the concept? So it explains an amazing idea. This chamber, this room, had a different name as well. If you look at the top of your hand, that I put it there, because it's a very hard name to pronounce. It was sometimes called Lishkat Ha'etz, and it was sometimes called Lishkat Prahedrin. Now, Prahedrin is not a Hebrew word. It's written in Talmud, but it's not a Hebrew word. It's actually a Latin word. I don't know any Latin, but apparently it's a Latin word. What does it mean? And why was the Kohen Gadol called? Why was the Kohen Gadol room called that? So again, here we have two layers of Torah. So the simple reason is a negative reason, and the negative reason is like this: what happened was, in the second temple, they started actually, which was under Roman rule, they started to call this room the office of the Prahedrin rather than the office of the wood. Why? Prahedrin means a Roman officer, right? But there was a particular type of Roman officer. It was a type of Roman officer, apparently, like a Roman minister, government minister, some sort of politician, that had a rotation system that they used to change them through the voting system, whatever the case is, every single year. So Prahedrin were Roman legislators that had a one-year term. And after that term, they were replaced by someone else. Okay. So why did they start to call the Kohen Gadol's room by that? Because in the Second Temple, there was an amazing problem. We know there was an amazing problem that some of the Kohanim Gadolim weren't actually up to scratch in the Second Temple. I think I've done the message before. In the Second Temple that stood for 420 years, during the time of the Second Temple, there were over 300 high priests. Why were there so many? Because many of them didn't last more than a year. Because what used to happen is they through the Roman influence, were able to get the post and not be completely worthy, right? And then they would go into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, and if a Kohen Gadol went into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur and wasn't quite ready for it, they wouldn't last the year. They wouldn't live through the year, right? Sometimes they would die instantaneously, sometimes it seems like they'll die afterwards, whatever the case is, but they wouldn't make it past Yom Kippur. So therefore, because that started to happen a lot during the Second Temple, they started to nickname this room, rather than calling it Lishkat Ha'etz, where the room of wood actually is a symbol of longevity. These Kohanim Gadolim actually didn't enjoy longevity, they actually ended up being replaced every year. So they became almost similar to the Roman legislators that got replaced every year. So they started calling the room Lishkat Prahedrin. Okay. That's on the surface. But again, the Rebbe says that there's got to be something deeper to it. Why? First of all, not every Kohen Gadol in the Second Temple was unworthy. There were many that lived very long, and yet it still had that name. Second of all, the name Lishkat HaEitz never disappeared. It was still called Lishkat HaEitz. It was still called the Room of Wood. And thirdly, these people weren't actually so wicked. There's a whole Kabbalistic explanation. Because if you think about it, it's a strange thing, right? The one Kohen Gadol goes in and he's not worthy, so he dies. It happens again the second year, the third year, the fourth year. You'd imagine like after about 10 years, people get the message, right? You kind of wouldn't incentivize people to become a Kohen Gadol. Right? So there is actually, I mean, if it happened to the last 10 Kohen Gadolim, you'd kind of be worried, right, about becoming one. And yet it didn't. They kept going for 300 of them. And some of the commentaries explained actually that these people weren't so wicked, actually weren't corrupt people. They were actually great tzaddikim, who did the wrong thing, but they were nevertheless great tzaddikim. They were great righteous people. They were people who were so desperate to experience the divine revelation of the Holy of Holies that they took the chance. That's how holy they were. Right? So we're not talking about people who were just, you know, terrible people. We're talking about people who were actually on an incredibly spiritual level. Now, that wasn't the right thing for them to do because the purpose is to live, not to die. Like the sons of Aaron are also very, very holy. And yet they died, expired because they came too close to God. So it's not something one is supposed to engage in if you're not sure that you're going to keep safe. But nevertheless, it's still a pretty heavy level. So the Rebbe explains this whole idea on a completely different level of what this idea of calling it the room of Prahedrin is, right? Because he says like this, what was the function of the Kohen Gadol? What was the function of this room? The function of this room was to train the high priest before Yom Kippur. What is the essence of Yom Kippur? The essence of Yom Kippur is the concept of tshuva. Tshuva. Tshuva means repentance, returning, fixing, repairing, and so on and so forth. What is real tshuva? What is the essence of tshuva? Right? What is the essence of tshuva? What is the essence of repentance? So the Rambam says that true repentance is a complete shift. It's a transformation. Tshuva is not just saying, I'm sorry and I'm going to be better in the future. Real tshuva, which is the essence of Yom Kippur, real return, real repentance, is to transform. To use the words of the Rambam, that a person becomes, goes through a process of reflection, remorse, reconnection, resolve, to the point where a person becomes a completely different individual. That you almost can't recognize them, sort of personality-wise. They become completely different. Right? To tshuva, like this is, and this is the idea of the month of Tishrei, when we come to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the idea is not just to say, I'm sorry, move on. The idea is to do something that sort of is transformative. A shift, what they call today a complete paradigm shift, a whole difference of who we are. Right? There were quotes, interesting halacha, there was interesting halacha that on Yom Kippur, where the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would go into the Holy of Holies, they would wear special, simple linen garments. The halacha was that once a Kohen Gadol went into the Holy of Holies with those garments can never be used again. The next Yom Kippur, he's got to have new garments. No one would imagine why. How about if he was a good guy, Kohen Gadol, and he lasted the next year, and he was in a pretty stable diet, and didn't lose or gain weight, and he was pretty same size? Why can't he use the same clothing? It was last year, it's a waste of money. Why should we throw away the garments? The answer is because the process of Yom Kippur was a process of transformation. Symbolically, once you go away, you become a new person. A new person needs different garments. It's a whole different person. The Yom Kippur that we are, the next Yom Kippur, is a different person than we are this Yom Kippur. So we have in Yiddishkeit two ideas, two concepts. One is the idea of consistency, which is represented by the idea of the tzaddik. Who is a tzaddik? A tzaddik is a person that just does things right all the time. A person who grows up in holiness, a person who acts in holiness, always doing things right. That has one concept, one lesson. Consistency is a very, very important thing. Then you have the idea of tshuva, that sometimes we're not always consistent, and we mess up. When we mess up, we have another opportunity. The opportunity is, we don't have the opportunity of consistency, but we have the opportunity of transformation, where we become completely different. That's a deeper thing in a way. This is symbolized by the two types of people that we talk about, the idea of a tzaddik and the idea of a baal tshuva. A tzaddik is a righteous person, a pure person. That's a person whose emphasis is more consistency. They're always doing the right thing, growing incrementally within purity, within righteousness. And then you have the person who is the Baal Tshuva, the person who does Tshuva, who repents. That's a person who enjoys and experiences not so much the concept of consistency, but the concept of transformation. Which is why explains the Rebbe that the room of the Kohen Gadol had to have wood, but the wood was covered. And why it had two names. It had wood because the idea of a Kohen, on the one hand, is the idea of purity. Chesed, infinity, The Kohen, and particularly the Kohen Gadol, represented longevity. Longevity is the idea of consistency. It lasts for a long time. It's the association with wood. It's the association of things that last day in and day out for a very, very long period of time. That's the one aspect of the Kohen Gadol, and that's the one name of the room, and that's why it had wood. But the wood had to be covered. Why? Because the main accomplishment of the Kohen Gadol wasn't so much his purity, his longevity, but his ability to inspire others to transformation, to inspire others to do tshuva, to inspire others to completely transform, which is why it had another name, the name of the Prahedrin. Prahedrin were these generals or these politicians that were changed every year. Not in a negative sense that it had to be replaced or the Kohen Gadol that died. The replacement that we talk about is the concept of transformation. That when you go through one Yom Kippur, you're now a different person going into the year ahead. Right? And that's why it had to have a different name as well, called Lishkas Prahedrin, which was a positive thing. It's not a negative thing. Because it was a negative thing, the Rebbe says, why would we call the holy name of the Kohen Gadol with a negative thing? Why highlight the negativity? The reason that we call it that name, the reason we use the name, which symbolizes the idea of not consistency, but rather change, is because the change is a positive thing. It could be a negative thing, where the Kohen Gadol dies and is replaced by another one, but also represents a incredibly positive experience, which is the idea of complete transformation, the idea of becoming a different person. And that's why the room had that name. That's the two names of the room of Kohen Gadol. So coming back to our parsha, that's the concept. The concept is that you have people that are pure, you have people that are great tzaddikim who represent longevity, but they also have an ability that they might be the people who are completely pure, but they might have the ability to inspire others to completely transform. That the people who need transformation to completely transform. And that is the concept of associating and connecting the murderer with the Kohen Gadol. Right? The murderer of the Kohen Gadol. Because the Kohen Gadol, on the one hand, works on both levels. The atonement for the murderer is that he did something against what the Kohen Gadol stands for. The Kohen Gadol stands for longevity, the eights, the wood, the whole concept of consistency. He shortened someone's life, which goes against the concept of longevity, and therefore he's tied into the Kohen Gadol. But he's also tied into the Kohen Gadol on the next level as well. That connecting to the Kohen Gadol and always thinking about the Kohen Gadol, because don't forget, the murderer sitting in the Aron Miklat, I'm sure thought about the Kohen Gadol a lot. Right, because his term in that city was tied into the Kohen Gadol. But thinking about the Kohen Gadol and being connected to Kohen Gadol also would hopefully inspire the person to transformation. The person who goes to the cities of refuge requires transformation, requires a rehabilitation, requires tshuva. It requires to become a different person. That concept is also tied into the Kohen Gadol, because the Kohen Gadol's function was to inspire people to transform, which was why his room was called Prahedrin. It was called by this Roman name that replaced every year. That's why the wood in his room was actually concealed. And it was concealed in the first temple as well. It was always concealed. Because the consistency aspect almost took a backstage. It took a back step. It was concealed because his main function was not his longevity. His main function was not his consistency or his purity. His main function was actually to inspire others to transform. And therefore the open part of the room was not wood. Because his function was more the second aspect of his room, which was the second name, the name of Prahedrin, which is the idea of transformation and change and completely becoming a new person. Tied into this concept that the Kohen Gadol goes in the next Yom Kippur, cannot wear the same clothes that he wore last Yom Kippur, because it's a different, it's completely different now. Right? And that's the idea also why Parshas Maaseh is in this time of the year. Because we are taught that when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, so of course we say in Davening, right in Yontif, that it was destroyed because of our wrongdoings. We caused the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed, and therefore obviously we need to reflect and improve on what we messed up to make sure that the Beis HaMikdash comes back and Mashiach comes. This concept of wrongdoing, it explains in many, many sources, that it's a similar sort of concept of anytime we transgress, it's a spiritual murder. What we're doing is we are tempering, we are weakening our own life force. Our own life force is divine, it's spiritual. When we do the wrong thing, we temper that. The particular wrongdoing that is emphasized during this time of the year, as we spoke about last week, is the concept of division and dispute and the baseless hatred that exists between people. Therefore, when it comes the 3 weeks, and it comes Parshas Maaseh, and we read about the death of Aaron, we read about the death of the Kohen Gadol. We read about the death of the first Kohen Gadol, which was Aaron. Therefore, the whole parsha, therefore, is tied into this concept of Kohen Gadol. we need to also absorb that concept, that the connection to the Kohen Gadol is not the concept of longevity of it, it's also the concept of transformation. And therefore in reflection, in trying to sort of emphasize and trying to work on and trying to strengthen the idea of unity, particularly during these days, as a way to bring the redemption closer, it has to be in a way of a transformative way, a way that connects to the Kohen Gadol, which is the second aspect of the Kohen Gadol, that concept of transformation, of completely transforming, and even doing it sometimes when it's difficult, and doing it in a way that makes us different than we were before, and that hopefully increases the hastening of the rebuilding of the third temple, which will come through Mashiach.